Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, we have our first big moves in the 2020 presidential race. Attorney Michael Avenatti and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick say they won't run for president. We're going to talk through what that tells us about the way the field might shape up and just how big it's going to be. Plus, an electoral fraud scandal is brewing in North Carolina. Did a Republican congressional candidate's campaign round up a bunch of absentee ballots and use them to try and swing the race? We're going to talk with Elena Schneider about exactly what happened there, bring in some fun historical context, at least I think it's fun, and talk about what might happen next as the 2018 midterms refuse to get put in the rearview mirror. As always, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. Today, that's December the 6th, so it's all up to date as of then. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We've got two of our national political reporters on the line, David Siders, joining from California. David, good to hear from you.
Good to be here.
And Natasha Kurecki on the phone from Chicago. Hi, Natasha.
Hey, Scott.
Thank you so much for joining us. And, of course, in the studio, we have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
All right, time for our first data point, two, or maybe it should be negative two. Two potential Democratic candidates for the presidency said this week, no, not going to do it. Michael Avenatti, who was a regular on the cable news circuit thanks to representing porn star Stormy Daniels in her lawsuit against President Donald Trump, released a statement saying he was not going to go through with a 2020 presidential bid. And maybe on the more serious side of the ledger in terms of political accomplishment, Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts, who was a big favorite of some of President Barack Obama's former advisors, also released a statement saying he wasn't going to do it. That was about 48 hours after Politico broke the news, of course. So hard to imagine two people more different, but here we are. Natasha, I'll start with you. You've been heavily involved in tracking both of these potential now non-candidates. But take us inside the thinking of both these people, Avenatti and Patrick, as they decided not to pull the trigger on a 2020 presidential run.
Right. Well, you nailed it when you said you couldn't imagine two people who are more different, and their reasoning for not running could have been more different. And I think with Michael Avenatti, what we saw was someone who, and this was in our headline, crashed and burned. I mean, he was someone who had positioned himself as the sort of the Democratic form of Donald Trump. And I think what really changed his fortunes was a domestic violence arrest in November. And, you know, it's really hard to run for president and talk about fighting for women when you have that still hanging over you.
Some of the old rules still apply, it sounds like.
Exactly. I mean, you know, here's somebody who, when you did see him go out and talk, and people did take him seriously, he did travel extensively across the country and talk to all these Democratic groups, helped fundraise for candidates and so forth, and crowds did like him, but he talked about his fight for women. And, you know, here he's fighting this domestic violence charge, and that is just the latest. I mean, there were so many issues with Avenatti, you know, legal issues. He's going through a nasty divorce. It's very contentious. There's investments that are under question. All kinds of people are suing him. But all of that stuff you could have kind of put to the side because it wasn't really penetrating. But something like, you know, being arrested for, you know, some of the allegations that were coming out. And then his explanations just kept evolving. So that, you know, that just was sort of the tipping point for him.
Yeah. And then on the other side, you've got Deval Patrick, who's a two-term governor, who's got this and had been talking for months about how he was forming a rationale, right, for what a Deval Patrick presidential campaign would look like. But ultimately, it sounds like he decided that he didn't really have it in himself to put him or his family through the gauntlet.
Right, that's right. And you know, he later came out with a statement saying that, you know, he just didn't, the process was a cruel one, and it wasn't something that he wanted to, you know, and he specifically said it wasn't just him, you know, it was the other people in his family that he didn't want to put through that. But he was taken so much more seriously, as a candidate because of his ties to Obama. And Team Obama, what's left of it, was trying to get him to run. So he had that behind him. He had this great narrative, this rags to riches story. You know, he's a two-term governor. All of that I think a lot of people were kind of surprised. They thought he was sort of a threat in the field. So it was an interesting takeaway in just 1 week of, two different, very different figures.
Absolutely.
Of calling it quits.
David, I wonder if you could kind of put this all in context for us of the broader. You had a really good piece this week about the so-called invisible primary and you know what's the behind the scenes maneuverings that affect a presidential campaign and say a lot about who's going to come out of it before the voting actually starts. But you also wrote that it's happening more visibly. It's almost like announcing that you're running is only a step. In the process of running, if that makes any sense. And a lot of people are kind of along in that process.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it used to be that the pre-2020 period, a candidate could, reporters would describe it almost quaintly to readers, saying, in the year before a presidential election, you have candidates out talking to donors and kind of kicking the tires. Jimmy Carter could hang out in Iowa unmolested. And I think now that's just not the case. And it's not just difference in media attention, although it's certainly interesting that TMZ is all over people like Avenatti and Beto O'Rourke. But it's also a couple of real structural changes, I think, within the party that will change this year's primary. And the first is this rise of small-dollar fundraising, which you really saw Bernie Sanders take advantage of in 2016, but now it's not just him. It's Beto O'Rourke, it's Elizabeth Warren, it's Kamala Harris, it's a lot of people who have big email lists. And then also, you have a stripping of Democratic National Committee superdelegates of most of their power in the nominating process. So while all the same things are happening, you still have these candidates having backroom conversations with donors, meeting with party chairs and party leaders. All of those things are still happening. The balance of power has shifted, I think, slightly to these more populist kind of appeals, because you can have a backroom meeting with a mega donor right now, but many of those donors are undecided. And if you compare the weight of that kind of meeting to, say, the weight of Beto O'Rourke pressing send on a fundraising email to his list, I think the balance has shifted to this more visible kind of primary.
That's a great point. So, Charlie, what do you, we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for the first, like, real concrete signals about what people are going to do in this Democratic presidential primary, and they were no's, right? Does this change the conventional wisdom, you think, that there are going to be 20-plus candidates out there, or do you think that we might actually end up with a smaller field than people have been talking about for a long time?
I don't think we got any clarity on the shape or the definition mm-hmm. of the field from the recent decisions, but I do think we got a glimpse at what the primary is going to look like over the next 6 to 12 weeks, meaning we knew it was going to be big, but now we're beginning to understand the level of volatility we're going to have. Think about it this way. That was a news cycle, one single news cycle in which two candidates dropped out and a front runner felt that he had to establish his position and make his mark on the primary. That was Joe Biden, who declared himself the most qualified person in the country to be president. So in any one of those in a normal news cycle in a presidential race is a pretty big deal. We had three of them there, and they barely made a dent. And what I thought was really interesting is that – so you have Deval Patrick, who was an accomplished governor. He leaves the race, but it doesn't even dent the number of governors in a race. We still have maybe a half dozen current or former governors who are still in it. He is an African-American who leaves the race. That's okay. We still have two or three other highly accomplished African-Americans running in the presidential race. So the field is just so big that we are going to be dealing with this amorphous field of candidates that's unlike anything we've had to contend with before.
I hadn't thought about it that way. That's a really interesting point. There's never been this kind of breadth of identity and experience in, and I mean he would have been one of the more experienced ones, I guess. But there's an unusual range of characters at play here. Natasha, what? So you know, now that these guys are kind of drop off the big board, so to speak. What's next? Like, what are you looking out for? Are there going to be more announcements like this, or more go or no go type things in the next weeks, or is it that people who aren't going to run kind of want to get out there early and just halt the speculation at this point?
Well, you know, I think we're going to see more people dropping out, and it could be halting speculation, but I think it's more like there's some oppo that's going to drop. They want to get ahead of it in that so they can control the narrative as much as they can. We're looking for any kind of filings for, you know, the next round's going to be exploratory committees. We're looking for who has money in the bank, how much money they have, who's starting to sort of like, you know, digital fundraising, digital ads, that type of thing. But I think we're all sort of, political reporters are bracing themselves for January. It's going to be insane. And I think that's where it's going to come fast and furious.
Charlie, what do you think awaits us in January, February, and beyond?
Well, I mean, I think, as Natasha said, we're going to have a glut of announcements. It's just going to be one mad news cycle after another, because we're going to have people getting in, which is going to be a huge splash. And, you know, shops like ours are going to be scrambling to, you know, write about the implications of Kamala getting in, or Bernie or something like that. We're invariably going to have a big name is not going to get in, someone who we all were counting on, somebody like maybe Joe Biden. I mean, I'm not saying one way or another that we have any clarity into his decision making. But if somebody like him drops out again, that has an enormous ripple across the landscape. So, you know, what I'm expecting is just sort of this mad scramble until the field is set. And that may not be until midway through the year, because there are going to be a couple candidates. And I have a couple people in mind who are probably sitting out thinking that the best possible way for them, their lane is going to be to sit and watch an enormous field develop, splinter, bicker amongst themselves, and they will come in as on sort of a white horse, as a white knight candidate, deep into the process.
Absolutely. All right. Well, just 23 more months to go, I guess, until we figure it all out. So, David Siders from California, thank you so much for being here to talk us through it. We will talk again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you.
And Natasha Karecki on the line from Chicago, same to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Charlie, I know you're going to be sticking around for our next segment. Okay, on to our next data point, which is 905. That is the vote margin in the still undecided House race in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District. The district stretches from the Charlotte suburbs all the way east toward Fayetteville, and it is the site of what might be the biggest election fraud in recent memory. That's why the race is still uncalled. That's why multiple authorities are investigating it, and it could end up stretching way into next year without someone being seated from that district. Elena Schneider, who covers campaigns for Politico and, to boot, is a North Carolina native, is here to help explain what's going on. Hi, Elena.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, start with the basics. Who ran in this race?
So this was one of the most competitive races in the country, and it drew nearly $8 million in outside spending, in part because Democrats felt like they truly had a shot here. So their candidate was Dan McCready, Marine Corps veteran, small businessman, young, clean-cut, really nice-looking guy, who ran against Mark Harris, who made a big splash by taking out Robert Pittenger, the Republican congressman in the May primary, in a real squeaker. And so this was really one that everyone was keeping an eye on, in part because it included a lot of the Charlotte suburbs, which is exactly the place where we expected and saw in a lot of 2018, where Democrats were able to really make a new foothold.
Okay, so you've set the scene. We know the players. Now, why is this race still undecided? And the State Board of Elections is investigating, and some district attorneys and possibly the U.S. attorney looking into absentee ballots in some of the counties in this district. What's going on there?
So this race, unsurprisingly, came down to a very slim margin, as you said, 905 votes. On election night or a few hours afterwards, Dan McCready, the Democrat, conceded, and it looked like Mark Harris was heading to Congress. But the State Board of Election, as you noted, refused to certify in late November this race, in part noting concerns around irregularities and in particular citing absentee ballot collection in two particular rural counties, Bladen County and Robeson County in North Carolina. And It's been a bit opaque from the State Board of Election in terms of what actually was going on. There's been some really remarkable local reporting about what actually has happened, but we're finally in the last couple of days getting some real information about what happened here. But it started by the North Carolina Democratic Party filed half a dozen affidavits of voters in these two particular counties, in these two rural counties, who said that when they had somebody come to their door, ask for their absentee ballot, and they would fill it out or partially fill it out and return it to this person who promised to turn it in for them. And that's really problematic because it's actually illegal in North Carolina. You can have someone who's a close family member or a legal guardian turn in your absentee ballot, but not anyone else.
And you're not allowed to have anyone else fill out your ballot
exactly for
you, no matter who they are.
Exactly.
Well, actually, I probably shouldn't go that far. I'm sure there are some folks who need help who are allowed to get it. But that's like a big no-no, even in states where this so-called ballot harvesting, other people turning them in, is legal.
Right. So that's sort of where we started to get a sense of what was actually happening here. And then we had all kinds of people diving into a bit of these numbers and looking at these two counties and what sort of the irregularities they might have spotted here. And at the center of all of this is this pretty unsavory character, Leslie McRae Dowless, who is known in North Carolina as somebody who has worked on campaigns in the past.
Who's working as a contractor for Harris's
exactly,
campaign.
And has a long rap sheet and is somebody who was hired by the Harris campaign to do what they, called him an independent contractor who worked on grassroots efforts, but very much was known as somebody who went out and collected and got absentee ballots. And he also is somebody who is not new to politics here. So back in 2016, Dallas actually worked for, still in this district in the Republican primary back in 2016, worked for a guy, Todd Johnson, who was crushed both by Mark Harris and Robert Pittenger.
While
getting crushed in Bladen County in those absentee ballots, he was able to get 220 versus Harris, who got 4, and Pittenger, who got 1.
Okay.
So, all right, we're already looking a little suspicious. Fast forward then to 2018, Dallas was then hired by Harris's Republican consultant, and Harris won Bladen absentee 437 to 17. And then again, you fast forward again to what we're looking at now, which is where in the 2018 general, where McCready won absentee ballots in every single, in all 7 counties except for Bladen. And again, this is another place where in Bladen, 61% voted for Mark Harris, even though Republicans only make up 20% of the county. So again, it's sort of the numbers look fishy. And as one Republican operative put it, there is an unbelievable amount of smoke. And now the key question is, what did Mark Harris know it and when did he know it?
And I want to bring in our legal advisor, Charles Mattesian, Esquire, to take. I mean, Charlie, so there's all sorts of obviously right. There's a Board of Elections investigation going on. There are potentially criminal investigations going on. There's also, I mean, the House of Representatives gets to decide who its members are going to be, right? I mean, they decide who to seat and who not. And maybe it's a moot point at this point because the Board of Elections hasn't certified the election yet. But we had Steny Hoyer, the incoming House Majority Leader, saying the other day, it's like, I'm not sure that we're going to want to seat Mark Harris until we get some answers to these questions. It kind of, we talk about impeachment as a political process, not a legal process. But, you know, there's something kind of similar about elections where the House has some jurisdiction over who joins it.
Right. And the House is the ultimate decider here. And what's fascinating is to sort of to see how both sides in Congress are interpreting this, because there are all sorts of strange forces swirling around. Obviously, Hoyer gets it out there and sort of was the first to really mention it prominently that, well, maybe we don't want to seat this guy. But I've been trying to watch how Republicans have responded. And they've tread very gingerly around this subject, because on the one hand, Harris knocked off one of their own. He knocked off Pittenger in the primary. So, you know, they're not really embracing him entirely. On the other hand, you know, they know something's rotten in Denmark. Like, clearly something's off here. And so, you know, they don't want to get out ahead of this and welcome this person who may have been involved in some sort of electoral malfeasance. Yet another force swirling in the background is the idea that, well, I don't know, we kind of think Democrats win elections by fraud anyway. So, you know, maybe they're lying and trying to steal a seat from us. So you've got all these factors swirling about in the background.
Well, and Elena, you know the history in North Carolina as well as anyone. The Republican Party there has really made like voter fraud a major rallying cry in recent years. And they're kind of being put on the defensive here, just as they're trying to pass some stuff in the legislature right now
right.
about this. It's like it's very turned on the heels situation.
Absolutely. So Republicans pushed through and really supported this referendum to the Constitution, which would have required people to show up with their vote with ID at the polls. And it was something that was approved by 55% in November. And now they're currently writing the language to try and push that through before they lose their veto-proof majority in January. And I think that in just the last day, they've added now language that somewhat at least starts to attempt to address this absentee ballot question, in part because they were feeling intense pressure that they were looking a little hypocritical here. And at least that's certainly what Democrats are trying to say and trying to point out here.
Charlie, now we talked about the role that the House might play in what's going to, and again, we don't know if this is going to get certified. It's possible that the Board of Elections could, they have the power to call a new election if
exactly.
they decide that a new special election, if they decide that the previous one was tainted irreparably. But Charlie, there's this amazing historical precedent of the House kind of getting involved in a really close election where there were questions and accusations about the vote count on both sides. And I'm talking about Indiana's 8th District. And take us back, if you could, to 1985.
Yeah.
And set the scene.
I mean, it's one of the, you know, most memorable, craziest moments in House history. You know, any textbook about, you know, the history of the institution would include this discussion about the bloody eighth in after the 1984 election. And I think for many people who are House junkies, the first thing you thought of when you saw how rotten this election was and how badly it smelled was you began to think about, could this be the next Bloody Eighth? And the Bloody Eighth refers to this district in southern Indiana that became famous because it was so fiercely contested for so many years. Like between the mid-60s and the early 80s, I think 6 incumbents were ousted from there. And then even after that, it was always so closely contested. You know, it would flip constantly back and forth and back and forth. And so in 1984, there was a really close election. So the House was completely different at that world in Washington at that time. And Washington was completely different because at that time, you couldn't even imagine what a Republican House might look like because Democrats had held the House. It was their crown jewel for nearly 40 years. And so it was a powerful majority. It was an arrogant majority. And, you know, without diving too deep into the process, which would be a little boring for, I think, a lot of our listeners and also for me to say, but without going into all that, this was a really close race. Democrats used their muscular majority to ram through their candidate, despite the fact that there was persuasive evidence maybe that the Republican who won that seat could have been seated in the House, and Republicans freaked out.
The Republicans are doing their best to see that a terrible injustice is righted. And if the majority doesn't like our procedures, they should understand you can always vote us down. And invariably you do.
In the House of Representatives, it was a pivotal moment for Republicans. In fact, I would argue that it was the wellspring of all the current dysfunction in the House. Now, you can trace a direct line back to that seat because even Gingrich says today and has said for years, and many Republicans of that era have said that they were so angry and so radicalized by Democrats seating their candidate in this close race in the Bloody Eighth that they never got over it, and it changed the House forever. The reason I bring that up is we've got this historic class of freshmen coming in, Democratic freshmen, and it would be really remarkable if this was their formative experience. They come in to transform Washington, and can you imagine if there is a contested race that goes to the House it occupies and sucks up all the oxygen in the House in their first year? And that is the risk when you have a contested race like this.
Now, and Elena, we mentioned this briefly before, the what happened with that, the Republican-controlled Board of Elections in Indiana said one thing, House Democrats said another thing in terms of the result. It's possible that we may just end up having a new election
right.
in North Carolina.
So the State Board of Election is made up of 4 Republicans, 4 Democrats, and 1 unaffiliated. And they're appointed by the governor, and they hold on to these seats for a number of years. And they are going to be in a position to vote whether or not to call for an entirely new election and rehash everything that we just went through over the last 18 months. Obviously not a new primary, but a new general election, which will again pit McCready versus Harris and then also a libertarian candidate again sometime in early 2019.
Mm-hmm. So we'll just have to keep an eye and see whether that happens or not. The Board of Elections voted 7-2 to investigate further these allegations. And so that's going to happen by December 21st is the first hearing. And then who knows how long it'll take from there. It's very possible, maybe even likely at this point, that the district won't have anyone seated from it when the new Congress starts.
I think that's likely.
All right. Well, we will be keeping an eye on it, potentially have you back to tell us more about it in the future. Elena, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Charlie, thank you as well.
Shikant, thank you.
All right. Our producer this week is Micaela Rodriguez, with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you all so much for listening to us this week. We'll be back with you next week.
What did you say?
I said Fayetteville.
Fayetteville?
Fayetteville. All right.
Thank God I'm here.
Oh, man. Yeah, really. Fayetteville.
Fayetteville.